Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Case Podcast with Alex, Heinrich and me, Sven. And today we want to talk about two topics, architectural thinking with regards to sensitivity points. We want to look at the, as an example, from folks, from the Volkswagen data breach. And also we want, of course, discuss AI assistance, AI assistance coding, AI assistance with software architecture. How are you doing, guys?
Good.
Now pretty
end
fine.
Of the week, end yeah. of the week, ready for the weekend.
Ready for the weekend. Maybe not too much because I will definitely work in the house again. But yeah, so actually more stressed out on Sunday evening than I'm currently.
So the work week is relaxation.
Yeah,
that sounds good.
It resonates. I mean, there's the saying, if you are a father, then you no longer have free time. You only have work and team events. And we have a ton of team events over the weekend planned. So it's going to be different, but overall doing great.
Yeah. For me, I also have events. Yeah. So, tomorrow is, we visit a school. So because my daughter is now going to high school, gymnasium. Mm-hmm. And, nice. we have to check a few schools and tomorrow is the last one we check out. So
good luck.
Let's see how this works. Yeah.
Nice. So, Sven, what is a sensitivity point? I don't know what a sensitivity point is.
Yes. I give you a brief introduction what happened, and then we at Volkswagen, and then we can talk about sensitivity points. Mm-hmm. So, there has been a huge data leak at Volkswagen. I don't know if you heard about mm-hmm. it.
KS Computer Congress. I mean, I think the talk went pretty viral.
Yeah, but it's a German talk, right? So the talk is in German. I'm not sure if it's available in English. That's something I don't know. But it's certainly the British police is concerned. I mean, everyone who has a Volkswagen is concerned. And so what happened was that a Volkswagen, Audi, Skoda, Porsche, and maybe more, I don't know. So from the Volkswagen Group, Seat. Okay. Mm-hmm. Their data have been leaked. And what data? So the exact position, so location data on the meter. At least at Volkswagen.
For Volkswagen and Seat.
Yeah, and for the other ones, it's actually different. It's like, I think, on 10 kilometers.
Yeah, something like that.
Plus personal data of the driver. So now, looking at those data, you know now who works, you know, for the British police, who works for the police in general. They found out people who work for the Secret Service, you name it, no? People who visit certain political events, who visit brothels, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. They know where those people also live. They know where their children go to school. So it's a pretty bad situation, I would say. Yeah.
Now, can I hook in here, actually, because it was never really clear to me, because the person who gave the talk, I think, was very much not a black hat hacker and spread that information widely. So.
Flipke. Is very, very well known in the security community.
No, I'm sure he's well known. But the question is, how far has the data leaked? Because there's a difference if this is kind of circulating on the black market and bad actors can take hold of it, or one party has successfully obtained this data set and then made a few nice graphics and kind of like making the press, but it actually didn't get into the hands of like other third parties. Do you know about that detail, how far the data was spread?
They say that they don't know. That's my understanding.
Like the bucket was open and readable to everyone?
And but they have audit logs knows. On the read, right? Didn't they have some audit logs there? I don't know.
I'm not sure, I have to say.
Okay. But I mean, let's assume that nobody really knows and it was open for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's hope nobody. I think it's a nice education point. Yeah. So nice thing for education. So now, how this happened, you know, how they were able to leak it, is another story. I think is a story for another day. You know, it relates to Spring Framework and health endpoints, which are in the wild. But I want to talk about sensitivity points. And in software architecture, a sensitivity point is a small piece of code, or maybe even a configuration, where two concurring architectural goals are balanced. Yeah. And it's really a tiny piece of code. And I mean, so often we treat code equally important. Yeah. You may have 1 million, but you shouldn't. Yeah. You may have 1 million lines of code, but they are, of course, not all equal. Yeah. So some represent functionality of your core business, which is important. Some code only supporting stuff, not so important. And I think a sensitivity point is super ultra important and needs a lot of attention. So Volkswagen decided to store the exact location. And obviously the others, so Volkswagen and Seat and the others didn't. It's probably only one line of code where they stripped the exact location data. Yeah. Maybe it's two lines of code or three, I don't know.
Yeah.
But if you imagine, you know, in this line, if you strip or not, what actually the impact is, yeah? So if I write here, if I strip it by two digits or something, it means I can predict a better battery life. And if I don't, no, if I don't strip, so, and if I strip, I cannot predict a better battery life. But on the other side, I really rank data protection very low. Yeah. And there was a lot of discussion that besides the data leak, that this you can prevent those problems if you do proper software architecture. Yeah, you have to understand your quality goals, and you have to know what is really important in your code. And I think that is a nice example of something which is really important, which you need to know. Yeah, Alex, you want to say something?
Well, what if not stripping it was a conscious decision?
If it wasn't a conscious decision?
No, if it was.
If it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure it was. I think they, but I think the problem with, I think it's okay, you know, it can be a conscious decision. But if it's a conscious decision to go that path, and I think it's totally fine, you know, if you say we track the data and we basically break our own rules, you know, the usage rules, mm-hmm. I think you can do it, yeah, but then you have to take a lot of other measures to protect your data, I think. Yeah, and was, I think that consequence they didn't follow.
What was interesting to me is that it was actually, if I remember correctly, it was stated in their terms of service that yeah. they would track the location of the vehicle up to 10 kilometers precise. And I think Seat and Audi actually kept to that promise in the terms of service, and VW and Seat didn't. They tracked the precise location.
So you said twice Seat. So it was Volkswagen and
Volkswagen and Audi did cut it and only had the 10 kilometers precise, and Seat and VW didn't cut it. And that's interesting. I mean, it's like you could say it's the same platform, it's the same software, but then again, like all, as far as I know, all of them have the have a claim in their terms of service that they would cut it, but Seat and VW didn't. So that's why I'm thinking. Seems like a configuration switch, and might be a conscious decision.
Yeah, I mean, I would. I mean, I don't know, but I would guess it's a conscious decision. But I think, you know, one thing I want to say is there are these, those, sometimes you have those few lines of code which are super important. And this is a very nice example. You know, it can really sink your project or your product if you are not, let's say, sensitive about it, which happened here. I mean, I don't know what, you know, this is a very expensive failure, I would think. Yeah. And, but what they didn't do, you know, it was a conscious decision to, or I, at least I think they didn't do, I don't know the details, yeah, what happened there, but I think they made a conscious decision. We rank let's say the prediction of the battery life or what, for whatever reason they need those exact data higher than data protection. And I think it's probably not fine to do so, but if you do so, you have to take other measures. And I think that was what they didn't do. That just my...
So it sounds to me as if you were advocating a sensitive software architecture education, because in the end, it's more or less a known practice in architecture evaluation and risk management. Right,
exactly.
To understand the risk that you have and what trade-offs you make in your decisions. Is that what you're advocating for?
Yes, yes, yes. So the last point was, I think it's a nice example, and the obviously it happens very often. Yeah, and the question is, what can you do about it? You say it's typical in software architecture education. Yes, it's typical in software architecture education, but
it's also
always
typical that nobody does it.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And so if you listen and you really want to know about, let's say, sensitivity points in your architecture or the risks which can sink your project, you know, what you have to do is you have to understand your most important stakeholders. You know, it's a very simple, let's say, algorithm. Know your stakeholders, talk to them, what's important to them. What do they expect from the system which has impact on your architecture decisions? What do you have to do in order to fulfill those requirements? Mm. Are there any trade-offs that need to be addressed? Is there any sensitivity point which you really have to balance?
You know what is interesting to me? When you started out with the story, I was smiling because I was thinking of an interview that I saw with Markus Söder maybe 4-6 weeks before that.
So Markus Söder, German politician.
Yeah, German politician from Bavaria. When he was ranting about data protection and that we're totally overdoing it in Germany. And if I remember correctly, the same guy, when he was asked, so he's, how is it called, ministerpräsident? So he's like one of
prime minister of Bavaria.
The CDU party in Germany. And he was like, when he was asked about this case, he was like, it's totally unacceptable. If the position of Secret Service locations has been spoiled by this, this is a complete disaster and people have to take consequences. And I'm like, it's interesting, right? Data protection is not of a concern as long as I'm not the victim.
I mean, I think both can be true, right? Both can be true at the same time. I think the friction introduced by data protection and the amount of pain, like, for example, us having like 16 different national security, like Geheimdienste in the different Länder, that's insane. The way that that the police is not able to share information, and the amount of like cookie banners we have to click because of like consent requirements for collecting data. That is all like a very, very valid concern. And here, I don't think the rules have really failed us in saying it was never okay, even under the laxest data protection laws, to expose this information unsecured via a public endpoint. It's really just gross negligence or insufficient testing or like not implementation of basic security practices. Maybe it's more complicated than this, but it's not a failure of regulation in this case that this has happened. Mm. And I'm not sure if even stricter regulation would prevent us from this.
Mm-hmm. I think you're going in the same direction the point that I wanted to make is it depends from which perspective you look at the quality goals that you have. But if we are saying like in general data protection, it might not be seen as a threat to your business.
I mean, data protection is this is one of the things that you cannot manage with an SLO, right? So usually like just it's kind of always a little bit broken, and then you kind of measure this, like how bad mm-hmm. is it, and you can kind of manage for it. Like security incidents like this is like either it's like there's no signal at all or it's really, really bad.
Exactly.
And to understand where you actually are in that situation is quite tricky. And what I was pointing to is it's probably not the regulation fault. It's like it's the way that those systems are deployed. Is the company culture really up to like keeping security at the core and embodying this, or having the right like penetration testing or other like support structures on their end that are effective mm-hmm. at covering like. This is not the question. The problem is not that this is legal. That was always clear that it's a very bad idea to have it. The question is how effective are we with defining this or preventing this with the practices that we have? And how much does it cost?
Data protection was actually not my intent, right? So I think you can take every quality goal, but this one is especially expensive. Yeah. But what you meant, Alex, just that I understand it. So what you mean is there are different stakeholders. There is Volkswagen, who thinks very different about data protection than another stakeholder, the buyer of the car. Is that what you meant? So you have
of course. I mean that's obvious. But my point was, even in the politician, you have like the same person. You have these different perspectives.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And it depends on like. Which context, which situation you're triggered in, exactly as Heinrich said, someone you might have the perspective of the consumer where I say, well, I don't want you to know that about me. And on the other hand, you can take the concern of the, let's say the business saying, yeah, but well, we need to make some money and we need to understand how you use our services so that we can make them better, more efficient, and actually make them better for you and make them cheaper to offer so we have a better gross margin.
Yeah, but I think here you have you have a little trade-off it's not a yes or no decision. Let's put it this way. So if I decide, I'm the stakeholder who wants to make more money. Now I want to have battery life prediction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an architect at Volkswagen, for example. They say, okay, what do you want? And they say, we need better. Battery life prediction. It makes us more money and everything is better. And then I talk to the people, to the stakeholder who represents the customer. And they say, it would be really bad and it's to if those data are leaked. You know, probably also public relations says, that could be, or legal. You have several stakeholders who tell me as an architect, I'm not sure if we should do that. So, and if you, and now we have to decide, you know, what are we going to do? And then we can say, okay, do you really need the exact location, or is 10 kilometers, is that still okay? Or 5 kilometers or 1 kilometer, you know, how can we strip it? Maybe 1 kilometer, maybe 100 meters are okay. If we have only 100 meters or 1 kilometer exact location, it's not perfect for the stakeholder who wants to make more money, but it makes the life so much easier for everyone else. Because even if you leak the data, it's not a big issue. You know, you leak the data, and I mean, if the data are one, if you're on 1 kilometer, it's not that bad, I would say.
Go ahead, Harald.
Yeah, I think it's quite tricky, right? And I think the trickiest bit about is how do you make sure those conversations are actually happening? Because for the developer that is programming the embedded device, and the developer that is programming in the back end, they probably are never part of this kind of political discussions that what kind of accuracy is okay. And even if they were, there is not a function that says tune accuracy, truncate accuracy to something. And if you are just doing naive implementation of any of this, chances are you are not really making anything better. So there's this avenue. And I have another tangent here, which is, but I will keep
maybe,
that for
maybe
later.
One, sorry, yeah. Maybe one word on this avenue.
Yeah.
I agree, the person who writes that line of code is probably not in that meeting, but there is a you have a very senior technical staff who should drive those decisions.
Wait a second. The question here is whether that technical staff is on board all the time, or counterargument, did we find a way to document something like that? I mean, Heinrich, you just said it's hard to put that into an SLO, but right? The question here is, it's an intersection of a functional and non-functional requirement, because in the end, we want to do something. So there is a reason that we gather some data, and it doesn't have to be the location of a person. It could also be the person's home address, right? It might be that we gather that data because, I don't know, we want to send packages to that person. So they actually have a benefit from that. And the question that I'm wondering currently about is, how can we make sure that we share the purpose of why we collect some data, and that this purpose is shared as metadata with the data? So if we say, okay, we also need the address somewhere else, let's say you have a customer profile where the customer can change their home address. And once a customer places an order, you pull that address and put it on the invoice. And on the invoice, you definitely never allow to change that address again, because it's an immutable document, right? So you have the former. So when the customer changes their address, you have the former address and the new address. But the address on the invoice is not to be used for anything. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it's used for, I don't know, analytics purposes, whatever. But how do we make sure that the purpose is shared? And how could we maybe monitor such sensitivity points, saying, well, it's critical that this is not used apart from the purpose that we initially collected it for? You know what I mean? Like, would there be a way to observe misuse internally?
So maybe I have one comment on, let's say, the purpose. Mm-hmm. I think that is doable, in my opinion, with, let's say, regular things we learned in software development, right? So we understand what stakeholders want. We build the system, and then very old paper, I need to look it up. It's like a 30-year-old paper. I forgot the title, but basically it's about software development is not producing text. It's about creating a mental model for everyone to understand what we are doing. So, and creating a mental model on, let's say, a smaller system, you know, one team, I think that's easy. It's not easy, but it's doable. Creating a mental model on something where probably 300 people work on, I don't know, that's probably very difficult. You have to choose your important architectural mental models wisely, I would say, and then try to educate the teams who work on the system what's important. I think that would be something which works. But how can you measure it? I don't know. I mean, that data observability, I would say, is something you are speaking about. That's something which is another episode, I would say.
Yeah, and this is actually a good segue here. Before I go to data observability, let me share one experience from a little bit related domain. I spent a long time in academia, and I was also involved with a citation networking project where we extracted from the archive all the different references between papers, because we realized we could build really great recommender systems if we have the network and not just like title and author information. So not searching on the text, but searching on the graph. So a little work with this. And I also got involved with people that are doing like citation management for a living. There's a thing called the Open Citation Corpus, and there are companies which are selling reference information. And one of the ideas of those people for a long time has been, well, you can cite actual papers because you like them and you would say like, this is something good. You could also cite them as everybody knows, this paper is rubbish, and you want to like associate reasoning and this kind of meta information to it. Mm-hmm. So you not only have links but you have semantic links, and they have context about them. And there is ontologies on how to do this and so on. And
exactly. Yeah.
And while this is like a nice conceptual framework that in theory solves the problem, in practice, nobody would ever bother to create that semantic markup for every like reference, like in the LaTeX source or in HTML source, that you have additional terms you put in the XML to annotate why are you actually doing that. And there are also questions with standardizations of the reference text itself. So how would you actually find the paper? And the DOI ID is kind of the solution that came along there. But nowadays, I feel like all of this is rendered pretty obsolete by AI. Because you have language model who can just read German and extract the sentiment pretty accurately from the text, or understand that something is a reference, or understand that a certain fragment of text is a part of a title and not part of an author, just because their conceptual contextual understanding of the language that is around it is so high. And so in this sense, I feel like some of this kind of contextualizing like references and use of references in this case is going this direction, just having semantics and systems that can capture it doesn't really mean they are useful if they cannot be effectively adopted. And that's also something, in a company context, it's always a little bit similar. It's a little bit similar, but also a little bit different, because you have like policies which you can just enforce and just make everybody do a certain process. But it's always nicer if you have gravity and it's naturally something that is suggesting itself. And for the case of the invoice information, I'm really reminded of this data lineage problems. So instead of forwarding the intent why something is there, maybe it's better to backtrack the source. So you have one point where you are managing policies and intent, which is where you are capturing the data in that store. And if you are accessing it, you remember the chain. So whenever you are rendering a document, like an invoice on a website, there could be a check saying, hey, is that actually immutable information that we are accessing, maybe directly or indirectly? Or are we allowed to share it with a certain party because there's a certain confidentiality associated with the source? So maybe that is...
You would get that from Lineage?
I mean, in theory, you could. If you knew where the data come from and you knew it's a confidential data set, you could infer.
So that would mean if I get the data is annotated with that information, or...
I mean, it could be on the label of the record, but I would typically expect this kind of beyond the level of the pipeline or the integration that you do with the data provider system. So you say you are making a certain query, you're accessing certain tables, and then you get information about the table and the lineage of the table along with it. But could also be on record and not record level.
So you're saying basically that we would categorize the source as, I don't know, confidential, secret, and therefore we would know that we must not share certain data outside the company, for example.
I think conceptually this would be an interesting way to do it, because the thing you want to, and that is extremely inconvenient, like if you have millions of records and for every record you are kind of attaching an additional tag saying, hey, this is private information, this comes from here and from there, just the amount of redundant information you are copying around everywhere is just quite significant. So either you are really clever of compressing this or so, or you're looking for different solutions. And I think Lineage is something that's absolutely critical to solve for a variety of use cases, including observability and debugging, right? If I have wrong data somewhere and I'm not sure where it comes from, then the problem is a lot worse than, okay, here is exactly where it comes from, here were the processing steps, here's like everything that happened along the chain. And once you have that kind of problem under control, which is very often not the case, but it's kind of a thing that has a lot of value, so there's a lot more willingness to also do expensive things to achieve it, then you also get the ability to reason about the source and you can potentially pass information along those chains. But we are in wild speculation land here, just tossing ideas around. Yeah.
I think, we are planning a little data series where we can easily make an episode on data lineage, I would say.
At least one, maybe 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe invite some experts on it.
Yeah, who know what they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That would be fine. Maybe coming back to the sensitivity points. I don't know what... Heinrich?
I have one more point here that I wanted to make.
Exactly.
So I'm really reminded of a password protection thingy that we implemented a long time back. And the line was just if license is valid, then we do something, right? So, and for me, this is somewhat very similar because there is a big void gap on the other side. You don't want to get this wrong. And yet the protection you put on it is super slim. So if I'm thinking it's the single if statement, this compiles down to a single jump in assembly that's evaluate that if and then jump away. And then the one side there's happiness. And then the other side there's, you just lost basically a lot of value. And I mean, that's also the trick how you are getting around some of these protections by just isolating this single jump and then flip a bit. But it also, just coding that line, I mean, there should be a mega fat comment around it and says, this is where the license validation happens. And then it's also a little bit funny because it's literally the content of the last line, but it feels like this is a super important line. And if you look at this from an industrial manufacturing perspective, imagine you have a fork, and then the one side there's doom, there's people die, and the other side is the heavy path. And then you have a sign to say, just go this way, please, right? That is the check, that just take the right way. And there was never fly in any security inspection. So it cannot just be a sign that everybody knows how to read. So what happens if the kind of driver doesn't look? What happens if the weather is bad and so on? Luckily, the case, what happens if the CPU just decides to flip a bit and ignore an instruction is not really a case we seriously care about or engineer for, except maybe if you do like aerospace thing with the gamma rays, but it's not a threat scenario that I'm worried about. So I'm never worried that the CPU is actually flipping this thing, but I still feel like this really feels like engineering this in a, with a, just a little bit of duct tape you're placing on this. And so, I mean, and an alternative here is just encrypt all the data which you need and pass it a key that you need to decrypt all the things. So if you don't have a license, there isn't just one jump instruction. It's just that you just have garbage data. And so I think there's like ways to actually implement a policy like that in code that are like super redundant and safe. And there's never a way that like that can go wrong because it's kind of manifest in the architecture. Versus, okay, you have the single line of code you can maybe manipulate within like a decompiler, or you can just easily you can fat finger this completely, right? Oh yeah, just code review went wrong, updated a comment in that line, and then this comparison was flipped. So that is like what kind of comes to mind. And if I'm making this decision, oh, am I leaking a million customer records? That should be probably something with a little bit more red tape around it. Yeah.
Hmm. I'd be it's careful with statements like, this could never go wrong.
You mean the CPU instruction being...
Yeah.
Have you... Okay, you are living in a different world. So I guess there's a story, Alex, do you want to share?
I got reminded, actually, when you... The thing, what you said, right? In the real world, not in software worlds... Yeah. Here is doom and here is happiness. Yeah. It's really not just a... in our world, often there is not even a comment. You know, you just come to that crossing and then it's like doom and paradise.
Yeah.
And you think, well, you know...
That's actually a nice bridge to... to our next topic.
I just want to have one more example because I think it's an interesting thinking about the sensitivity points here. Because Dan North, he once worked for a high frequency trading company, and he said one of their sensitivity points, it's not even a trade-off, you know, it's just it's very
learning
important.
It the hard way.
It's you just cannot lose the connection to the stock exchange, the electronic stock exchange. If you lose it, you know, you're done for the day, you know, that you just cannot catch up with the data stream coming in. Yeah. And they said, we did everything possible that you do not, that it's basically impossible to redeploy the service or, you know, whatever. Making a mistake here, they took all kinds of measures. There was not just a little sign, you know, they implemented a lot of measures to make sure it's, it's a very rocky road to lose the connection to the stock exchange, and I'm just thinking about the same, you know, at the Volkswagen part. If you want to change that little piece of code, it has to be a very rocky road. But how do you do that? Yeah, how can you do that? It's, I don't know.
That's what I said. I'd be interested in ideas in turning this into service level indicators.
Yeah, but that would be a different thing, right? Is it a service level changing the lines of code? Is that a service level indicator? No.
Well, I would say you could potentially write a check for your CI/CD pipeline.
I, The most direct thing that comes to mind is really is privacy protection of your customers, a product feature that you want to measure for, right?
Exactly.
So you want to have the accuracy of the location is always lower than 10 kilometers, right? So if you articulated this as a promise you are making, there are definitely ways to engineer a check that makes sure this is in practice happening.
That's my point, yeah.
And I'm not sure if this is best done in a CI/CD pipeline or more like in a continuous probe or like analysis script, but it's like, this is definitely engineerable.
It's kind of a significant
effort, but it's relatively straightforward.
I would see this as a check, for example, in a canary deployment, saying this thing does not go live if this check fails.
Yeah.
So that's why I said CI/CD
and
pipeline.
For final words on the sensitivity points, the canary phase is always on the board members of Volkswagen. In case of Volkswagen, and of course, Markus Söder.
Okay.
Anyway.
I don't want to switch shoes. No. I think being at the steering wheel at Volkswagen, that's not a fun job.
But coming back to the statement that you made earlier regarding there should be a big fat line to give instructions to developers. We recently did a little hackathon mid of December at Vorwerk, and a colleague of mine. So it was about AI aided software development, and a colleague of mine, actually a security engineer, stumbled upon very interesting generated code where I think it was ChatGPT that actually created the code for an iOS application, so Swift code, and he was really teasing that thing. It was about implementing passkeys. So it was a very simple application that should implement passkeys. And the after a few back and forths, the ChatGPT generated code, and in the middle of the code there was a comment saying, replace with actual security here. That was like the joke of the day. The rest of the day was done. It's like, replace with actual code here. That was interesting.
It's a good hint, to switch topics. We have AI-assisted programming and AI-assisted, let's say, architectural work. And I have a similar story on using AI assistance on threat modeling.
Mm-hmm. The interesting part for me was like, I said, well, Stefan, obviously, the LLM said, if you know better, then do the shit yourself.
I couldn't be bothered to put actual security in there.
But that was interesting. It's like, as long as you don't notice, everything's fine. But if you do know, then... But hey, it left the job to him. So... Actually, that's also fine. But I mean, that wasn't the only experience of the day, but let's dive into the topic. What are your experiences with the topic of AI aided software development lately?
I love it and I hate it at the same time.
I mean, for security reasons, I think I have a nice story on that from InnoQ,
please.
And there is someone, Birgitta Böckeler from ThoughtWorks, and she works on AI assistance, everything, right? So we could also possibly invite her or Michael Feathers or both, to have the experts. Mm-hmm. They were playing around with using LLMs to support you with things like writing architectural decision records or making threat modeling. Mm-hmm. And I thought, ah, that sounds good. So, you know, I made an internal presentation about it on InnoQ, at InnoQ. And I also played around a bit. And the interesting thing was, when I played around with it, is it's those things help if you really know what you're doing. And that was also the feedback of my colleagues. Yeah. So if you, I mean, I'm not a security expert. So I shouldn't use, I mean, it's not only ask, it's not about just asking the LLM what to do. It's really like you have, you create, you have prompt, you have a prompt which really guides you through the process. So there is a lot of prompting effort and prompting logic into this. Mm-hmm. But you can only use it if you're an expert. Yeah. So if you're not an expert, it's rubbish. Yeah. You can still use it, but you shouldn't. And probably the same is true with code. You know, you can use it, but you should really know what you're doing. If you don't know what you're doing,
then, you still use it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
then things happen. But,
yeah. Does this mean that we as software developers get a lot of new jobs in 3 years cleaning up code bases?
Well, I mean, there is this statement from, was it Andre Kapathy from 2017? Where he wrote about software 2.0, right? Where you basically don't have to write deterministic code anymore. So software 1.0 would be the deterministic code that we write in programming languages. And software 2.0 would be, so to say, the role of a data labeler, where we do reinforcement learning of large language models that, so to say, argue with each other, and you have maybe an agent-based system that does all the things. And in 2017, that sounded like, at least to me, it sounded like total fiction. And back then he was working at Tesla, as far as I remember. And I mean, in the meantime, we all know, right? Full self-driving mode in Tesla is based on this kind of architecture. So it's not fiction anymore. It's actual working in cars, or most of the time working in cars around the world. And the question that I take from this is, what are concerns that you have in such systems? And how specific does your domain or the domain of your data have to be in order to work like that? Because the statement back then was, if you have a complex environment, so complex from complexity management, we differentiate complicated and complex, saying complicated, we think we know all the variables and most of them we can influence. And in complex scenarios, we definitely don't know all the variables that will influence our result. And certainly we cannot influence all the variables. So we cannot control them by ourselves. And so to say, we in complex environments, we need to like work or do and adapt. So that's the classical build, measure, learn scenario. And I was really wondering, how far away are we from this situation still? Because if you see the amount of sensor data that Tesla collected over the last, 10 years? It's quite some data.
Yeah, I'm too far from the automotive space to really have a good gut feeling around how near self-driving is and what the AI model is that is going to allow to do this. But with text and code, it feels like a lot closer, and I feel a little more competent to talk about it. But I'm still like struggling to extrapolate this even 2 years out, right? So the evolving is so fast. I don't know if we will need coders, if you like, but I'm also not panicking, right? I am very that what I can see is that for good people, like you just described, for experienced people, it's a huge accelerator. And that's definitely the part where I'm excited about. It's like you can accelerate a lot of things. You can engineer a lot of stuff with a lot less knowledge about libraries and just syntax by instructing LLMs. And like just personal example, like 2 days ago, I did my first TypeScript project ever. Mm-hmm. I wanted to try it for a long time. And then I finally had a little like pet project, some visualizations of trees that I wanted to write. And the mm-hmm. first thing is usually this would have been a 2 week project with me, like relearning some, like, I don't know, visualization framework, being it some mm-hmm. Pi game stuff or JavaScript, and then implementing the tree logic. And then, like I said, maybe probably 2 weeks if you only do an hour or two at the side. And that was kind of possible within a train ride. So this kind of projects were completely just within reach. And so the other thing is...
What did you use?
Yeah, and this was the tech choice was then, well, I would usually just do the thing that I'm most familiar with, some Python hacking or some just like very mm-hmm. basic JavaScript hacking. And I said, no, I want to learn TypeScript. So, and then I used this code editor called Cursor, which has a very good AI embeddings with the Anthropic mm-hmm. models. And I just said to it, like, please bootstrap a TypeScript application. Like I didn't even know about Vite and all this JS bundling thing. It just bootstrapped a standard thing and it said, please create a make file for me so I know how to use it. And then mm-hmm. I type make and then it has the dev server running and all the stuff was already going. And then I knew I wanted to have an SVG canvas. So I said, please create that. And I knew I wanted to create kind of the nodes dynamically with vanilla TypeScript. So no like reactive frameworks in the middle. So I had a very clear image, like what technologies I wanted to use on the client. I had a very clear mental model, how I wanted the code to work, how I wanted to decouple the algorithmic from the visualizations with the two classes, but I had zero experience with TypeScript. Mm-hmm. I was pretty rusty I'm still pretty rusty in just typing this kind of data structures down. And that was... like it was all well within the realm what LLMs can do today. It's basically a few hello worlds stripped together and then
it's just rapid prototyping.
Yeah,
come on.
Exactly.
I mean, right, yeah. for just prototyping an idea, and there are so many things out there. I mean, Cursor is like made for developers. It's I love it, really. There are other things out there, like I think you already mentioned Lovable, right?
Yeah.
Lovable.dev. I have to say I do love ChatGPT for certain things. Like a colleague of mine is using that most every day, and ChatGPT can create Swift UIs from a picture.
Yeah.
So you just provided a picture and say, hey, create me that in Swift UI, and that works. It's really, really nice. And what I found from personal experience, like while I like Claude better to write texts that humans have to read, I like the ability to create custom GPTs to challenge each other. So to challenge each other's output, that was pretty interesting, because the as you just said, I thought, okay, that's a pretty like simple application that I created there. Let's ask the ChatGPT whether it has some issues. And the same prompt, like the same chat, didn't find anything. But when I put this code into a new chat window and said, hey, assume the role of a security engineer that does some pen testing. Please analyze that application for me. What do you find? And please also recognize OWASP 10 violations and other common security mistakes. And it was perfectly able to analyze that. And then I was like, that's interesting. Let's use another persona and maybe use a QA engineer to suggest me some like, how would I do quality assurance? What could be like quality goals that a QA engineer anticipates? And it would not only suggest me quality scenarios, but also how I could test them and generate some tests for that. That was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I have one question on that because, I mean, I must say I also love using ChatGPT for all kinds of things. But most of the time for work, it's only small stuff. Like, give me example code. I need to have a Splunk query and I never used Splunk, for example. Yeah. Or lately, you know, I have to use PowerShell and I have no fucking idea how to use it. And,
perfect.
And it's amazing.
Yeah.
But if I have a larger code base, my problem is, you know, analyze this larger code base from the viewpoint of a QA engineer or from a viewpoint of a pen tester or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much context information do I have to give the system. You know, is it just enough to say, here is the source code?
Yeah.
And that's my guess. And then the little experiments I did was like a system I know. Yeah, mm-hmm. I just wanted to know, here's a system I know, and just tell me things I don't know. And of course, if you just say, tell me, you know, this from a perspective of a QA engineer, you get a rubbish answer because you don't provide enough context. And then I add context and context and context. Mm-hmm. And I always felt like, it's not just an expert like me. You know, I know the code base and I have... If I give it all the context it needs to have a good analysis, I have to invest a lot of time. But it was just, you know, it was one project and one thing I did.
Yeah.
But that was my feeling that, you know, I just want to know how you guys deal with the right amount of context.
You want to go first?
Yeah, I mean... On a very high level, I think a year ago, it was still a major problem because the context windows were so small. And we are getting to models which can have like millions of tokens as context, like really large. So in theory, we should be moving to a point where the model can just load a very large code base as a context and have it kind of accessible. On a more practical level, I also struggle at exactly this point. Working with Cursor, I sometimes notice that he will kind of look at the directory tree and then look at some of the files selectively based on prompts that I give it. So there seems to be something already like built, like an agentic workflow that is taking care of this. So probably you can build something similar like that just manually by giving it a directory listing and basically asking it, hey, which files do you want to take a look at? But maybe, I mean, I would kind of bet this is like semi-solved. I was just today Googling for a LLM tool that is basically summarizing code projects for me, right? Just I should be able to do that with a like command line tool saying summarize this Git repository. I couldn't quite find that, but it would be a subset of what Cursor already does.
Did you try GitHub Copilot, the latest edition?
I regularly use it, but I didn't specifically try out newer versions.
Okay. So I have to say, I saw Copilot extensions when they released it somewhere early last year, and was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. But in the meantime, you can have custom extensions, right, for your project, for your company, so with your company content. And it will also be available, if I saw it correctly, in the GitHub UI. So that was interesting. Once you can use that, for example, in your GitHub Actions, that that might be interesting.
Can you explain this better? What is Copilot extension?
Copilot extension is assume a chat and you not only have one person, but you actually have multiple experts sitting there. So there might be an expert where you say, at Docker, can you analyze my Docker file and do some recommendations? And this at Docker would then trigger the Docker extension of GitHub Copilot that has specific knowledge about the CLI, how to deploy a Docker container to, for example, Kubernetes and Kubernetes API and things like that. So the extensions are specific, so experts with specific know-how of a certain domain. And this could be an extension that has specific know-how on your system environment. That's at least how I understood it. I'm currently exploring it and thinking about implementing something like that. But that is pretty interesting. At the moment, I do this with custom GPTs in ChatGPT, where you basically say, for example, you add API specifications as a file, and you can in these custom GPTs you can also add like additions to the prompt. Right? Yeah. You have a window where you can say, "Hey, assume the following role," and what you can do. And I never realized that until a colleague hinted me at that and said, "Well, if you don't describe what they find in the PDF, how should they make sense of it?" And I was like, "Yeah, okay. But how should ChatGPT make sense of the PDF if I don't tell it what it will find there?" Right? And once I did that, the quality was that was really good. Like explaining what it should use this PDF for and the other PDF for. I thought it would take that from the file name, but of course, if you provide more context, that's better.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah, giving more context. So Cursor, for example, it looks, or also, I mean, I never used really Cursor, but I used IntelliJ AI Assistants, and it looks on the source code. And I think source code is not enough, obviously, as context, because we talked about sensitivity points. Some parts are more important than others. And I'm just wondering, how can I combine, when I'm developing or just analyzing a code base, I have source code and I have some sort of documentation. How do I put both into a context window to ask, let's say, Copilot. Is that easy? I mean, I've never done it. Yeah.
The question is, like, is there something out of the box that already does it that is hooking into your IDE workflow? And I'm not aware of that. And the other question is, could you build something relatively easily, maybe with AI existence, that is able to answer questions that you have? And the answer to the latter is, I think, yes.
So I'm not sure. I mean, we can also ask the listeners to propose something in the comments, right? But I'm not aware that there is something out of the box apart from the custom GPTs and the project feature that you have in, at least in Claude and ChatGPT, it's available.
What is the project feature?
Project feature is basically that you say you can use the whatever model you want, like in ChatGPT, you can choose 4.0 or 0.1, and you execute your chats within the context of a project. And the project is basically a set of documents and a description on, like, we're working in company X, and this is the project that is going to build, I don't know, a new e-commerce shop. And our surrounding systems are the following. We have to attach to the following API specifications of these systems. That could be put into the context of a project, and that information would then be put into each chat that you have with the GPT-4.0 or the 0.1. And especially when it comes to let's say, some more reasoning, some more complex topics. So for example, I use the O1 in a project context. So in a ChatGPT project context to challenge my architectural designs.
Yeah.
So some architectural ideas that I have, and, I have a custom GPT that behaves as a not so nice colleague. Let's call it to be family friendly, right? And that would always give me destructive comments on why my designs suck, why this can never work in production, and what mm-hmm. would fail, mm-hmm. and what horrible scenarios might come up when we implement these designs. Yeah. And that's pretty interesting, because that, like, someone asked me, why do you do that? And I said, because then I get rid of that voice in my head, because beforehand it was happening inside and now it's outside and I'm a much happier person.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Usually you have a role in a project, you know, one person who is always challenging the others, let's say. Yeah.
In German, they call this Hauptbedenkenträger.
But there's also an English term for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
The one who always has a counter argument. No.
No, I
So, I don't know. It's like I'm always concerned. I'm always like caring about everything. And now you have a GPT, and that's pretty interesting, because so far you cannot clone humans, but you can clone personas, right? Everyone can use that GPT now and say, well, I want to have that colleague that destroys my ideas.
Yeah.
Let's see what
Devil's
they will
advocate,
find.
By the way.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I was about to ask ChatGPT about it, but when I formulated the question, it came to my mind.
I see.
Okay. Well, here's the thing I want to try is just to give it context about my calendar, my to-do list, my emails, maybe to some degree. And then
but that
just,
would be an assistant, right?
Yeah, it would be more of an assistant. But I basically want to hire the ChatGPT as my boss, that is kind of a micromanager, and just tells me what to do every day and how I could structure my day and mm-hmm. kind of what kind of things are objectively best to reach my goals. And it can, like, it does have a lot more context than I have, which is very tainted by the recent team events I attended with my, like, over the weekend. And the context loading is expensive. So it's sometimes also working remotely, hard to get started and not to know exactly what is like the best thing to do, and just getting some inspiration could be interesting. Yeah.
What is really challenging for me is when you have scenarios where you need a reliable response.
Yeah.
And you assume, would I talk to a human? That human would give me a reliable response. And now I'm talking to an LLM and the LLM hallucinates, and actually that API endpoint doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, humans never make mistakes, right? I don't remember that I ever got an API endpoint wrong. Never happened.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm really thinking like, how can we be a little bit more resilient in terms of, like, in Cursor, you have this, you have these suggestions for code and you can accept them.
Yeah.
And like in real life, when you talk to humans, you wouldn't click and accept everything that they say, right? It's like, it's not going to happen. I mean,
depends
maybe
on the person.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm frankly, I'm just not interested in the code. That just let's try out if it works. If it works, then okay, let's maybe just look how far we get before we really have to start thinking. I think, and this is also how I like operate with people. Like, I don't necessarily like the beauty of management is that you are able to operate of a higher level of granularity. So I don't want to like understand everything you do if it works.
And that's
that
my
is
point.
A blessing. Yeah.
Isn't that the philosophy of test-driven development, where you say, well, I know what I want to achieve, so I phrase the quality check.
Yeah.
And once I have code that works, then the job is done. And then I can start to optimize efficiency and other quality aspects. Right. But the functional job is done. And that's probably something that an AI coding assistant can help us with.
That's certainly a way to look at it. My hunch with this currently is like, if I'm just articulating problems and high level product ideas to the LLMs, they get stuck a lot in details that they cannot maneuver themselves out of. Like, for example, in TypeScript, you have a lot of linting feedback and stuff that they are automatically acting on. And I would have the LLM argue with the linter for like 10 minutes at some points and just continuing like adding if statements around stuff. And now they just get the types a little bit weird. And so it's like you have to kind of come in like a adult supervision and say, okay, stop, you maneuvered yourself into a corner. Revert to the last git commit. We're trying this again. I will give you like smaller bits to chew. But I think the direction is relatively clear. And this is also like what I see like extrapolating. It's like people will just click a lot of accept and trust manual testing and accepting AI prompts. Yeah. That is a new way to work. I've heard people that are coding via voice. So they are no mm-hmm. longer actually writing code, but they are talking to the machine and just looking what the machine does and trying it out. I think that is a reality that will just happen. And that, of course, means that the proficiency that the human engineers have with the code, working with the code, is lower. Also in like scenarios where like you have to debug a production system. And I'm not sure what the right way to navigate that kind of trade-offs and what the safeguards are that will allow us to ship code effectively in this environment yet. But I think this is clearly the direction this thing is going.
In the end, I mean, we have quality checks, right? I mean, this could happen to humans too, right? And we have quality checks in our pipelines.
Yeah, but are they sufficient to operate in that environment? That's the question.
That's a good question, yeah.
Yeah. And I think we will figure this out. I don't think this is necessarily a sharp edge where it's just like, okay, suddenly you have a little bit AI in your production and suddenly everything goes south. And also on the debugging side, you get help, right? You can, because you can also ask a model, you are in like a world-class debugger and kind of figure this out, help me figure this out. And you can also load the source code as context to figure this out.
I find it interesting that you say people talk, they just speak and then they wait until the LLM spits out some code. 2 months ago, I was also talking to a person and he said he was not a programmer, but he said he's constantly speaking to his LLM like an hour or something. He's thinking loud and is constantly talking to it. And then he says, okay, now write me an article about whatever, make some structure about out of my weird thoughts. Yeah. And I initially thought it's a bit weird, but sounds like an interesting idea. But now when I hear you, I think maybe I should try something like this more often, talking to the LLM and then let it make sense out of it.
What I do is I have the otter.ai transcription software that usually is for recording meetings. And when I go for a run, I would start the recording. And then I would just like download stuff that is top of brain. Top of mind, just in a way that I'm reflecting on stuff or I'm taking some notes for myself, but instead of like listening to an audiobook, which was the old default, and I'm switching back and forth between those. But if I'm just like, let me meditate and think something through, I just put on the voice notes, right? And recording this. And then sometimes I kind of have a train of thought that actually went somewhere and I made a couple of good points and I maybe have a bullet points with three sub points that I kind of managed to articulate through like a 45-minute run. And then I take the transcript, copy it to ChatGPT, and I say, like, create a draft from it. And that's a great start where you can kind of start doing some polishing, but it allows you to jumpstart a lot of like longer emails or small documents.
Recommendation: try out Notebook LM and ask it to create a two-person podcast from it. I was like, what the heck? And it actually created new arguments because it really created conversation of it. That was interesting. That was really interesting.
I mean, when I'm on my bike, I'm also thinking about stuff. And then when I come back home, I mean, you're usually very long on the bike, you know, like 3 hours on the bike. But you know, now I'm interested, how can I use this? So how are you talking to Otter AI? Do you have a microphone with you and your cell phone, or how does it work?
I basically just take the podcasting setup I have and then I strap it to my torso. No, I have I don't have the exact model, but it's like basically an AirPod thing. And I put it under my Mütze, that's cap. So it's a little bit. I don't know, but the audio kind of works out this way a little bit better. And then the transcription is really excellent. So it can deal with like a lot of background noises and stuff.
Okay.
Nice. When you said it's not that everything goes south and like people talking to their coding assistants. When Google came up with their Gen AI app builder last year, I was like, ooh, wow, that is the break even for the no code platforms out there. It turns out that it didn't go that direction, which was a little bit surprising to me, but there are other products in that direction. And I'm really curious in which direction this will go, because like if they become a little bit better, and I mean, I shared the experience of paste a picture of a application UI to ChatGPT and it creates the code for it. And you can afterwards ask it, no, move the button a little bit further to the right, and it will do that. I'm really curious how fast we will get into scenarios where people who don't really know how to code, so who don't know any programming language, will be able to create applications. Because in my perception, a programming language is a way to express myself, to talk to a machine, to talk to a computer. And it's in no way different than I use languages to talk to humans. But in the end, you want to have the effect that you're able, that the other, like your vice versa, will understand what you want or what you want to tell it. And the same as Facebook, for example, is working on that translator LLM that currently speaks 48 languages, I assume there will be some LLMs that will be able to create application code, and not actual code, but like the binaries, for example. And that's going to be very interesting for the whole software industry. If you think over that for a second, it's like there are open source LLMs at the moment that are really powerful. And if we're thinking, okay, there is no source code anymore that you can version, that where you have versions that you can go back to, right? How is that actually working? Where is that application running? Where will that data be located? Like all the operational quality aspects that we have. What about that? And I'm comparing the situation to the situation that we had with word processors back in the 70s, 80s, right? When personal computers came along and people were able to like not go to a specialist to lay out some, to lay out some text, but they could actually do that on their home computer and print that and have a beautiful document. And I would assume quite soon we will have Microsoft Access kind of applications out there again. And that's going to be interesting from an operational perspective.
Yeah, I don't know the the status from today, but maybe half a year ago or a year ago, Crady Booch talked about it. And his opinion, you know, he had two, like, I remember two opinions on that. So number one is the tricky part is obviously to tell the computer exactly what it needs to do. It doesn't matter if it's a programming language or if it's mm-hmm. a real language, but you have to be able to, at least you need to learn that skill to tell it exactly what you want. Yeah. I think that is something a non-programmer can learn quickly. I would guess, yeah. Maybe not everyone, because, you know, the devil is in the details and stuff like that. But one thing which I, you know, which is always in the back of my head is you can create it, but you need to update it. You know, creation exactly. is maybe easy, but, you know, now someone's saying, I want this different.
And that's my point.
We all had these
Word documents where people indented text with spaces, right? And I'm thinking of exactly these Word documents when I'm thinking about the no code movement. That's exactly my point. Like, how will the architecture and the maintainability of these applications look like?
I think you need source. One thing is you need source code. There needs to be an intermediate language.
Maybe.
I would guess, you know, that's, I would still think there needs to be an intermediate language. And from the design perspective, yeah, it's, you know, how do you group service? Who decides on the LLM needs to decide on your context, you know, what are your cohesion criteria?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if
what
if
about
it
sensitivity
can.
Points?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something you can feed. You can say, you know, this is important to to this uh-huh. stakeholder, and this is important to other stakeholders. It probably can create a sensitivity point, but it will ask me, you know, what do you want, the exact location of the driver, or what do you need?
Yeah. I'm very curious, and that's another topic that I'd like to dive deeper into. I definitely will, and in one of the next episodes I might bring you some examples. And I'm currently trying to find an expert in this area, maybe, that we can also talk to.
It's yeah,
yes.
I think Michael Feathers is an interesting person. He writes currently a book about it.
I agree. The question is for that topic.
Yeah. He writes a book about AI assistant. I mean, he writes a book about AI assistant programming.
Yeah. But that's the specific thing about no code, where like a non-technical person would be able to create an application, and that's challenging because. If you have an AI assistant and like, if you're a seasoned developer that knows something about software design and methodologies, you will implicitly apply that knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure he thought about this. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. But we can check with him. Grady Booch certainly thought about it.
Yeah. Let me add like two aspects to this. So I think one of the key questions is, are you using the LLM like a compiler or like an interpreter? Because you can also think of an application that actually runs on the LLM, that is basically a prompt for an LLM. And then the LLM would interpret kind of its instructions along with the user input and produce some outputs. And you could easily think of this having a UI component to it. I think that's not too far away. And that would be like one fairly general way to build applications. Probably very expensive, but it's at least one way you can hold it. The other way to hold it is more like a translation problem. That is, like, instead of using a compiler to go from C to assembly, you are using an LLM to go from natural language to Java to, like, and then feed another compiler. And and I mean, I think your comments with regards to proficiency is like, if you are confronted with operational problems and you are on the hook for it, you will figure it out. I'm not really sure how this figuring out would work, but if you, I think, compare this to the conversation in the, I don't know, 60s or 70s, when like the hardcore programmers, the seasoned programmers who were kind of carving the bits into the cards were there, and they're looking at these kids who are playing with higher level languages like Algol, and they were also saying, like, how could anyone that is not like carving bits and knows how the CPU works really debug a problem when you are just playing with these words in this Algol like text editor? So I think that sentiment would be similar, and I think the answer is, like, hopefully the abstraction is the answer is always people will figure it out. People are smart. People will just like it's also selection, right? The people that figure it out survive. You could look at this way. So it will solve itself. The other thing is the levels it's of abstractions that we are working with these days have been proved to be reliably like watertight or proof. So if you are operating a certain level of abstraction, you can usually fix your stuff by operating on that level of abstraction, and you don't have to peek so much deeper. So it's possible that you learn just enough Python that you can kind of debug the problems you are running into. At least that would be like one way this could potentially like pan out. Yeah. And I mean, the context I have is like the level of technical proficiency I had in my former company, where we were like, okay, we need to kind of understand what the Solaris kernel is doing in order to operate our database that we have written ourselves in order to make our customers happy. Yeah. That was like a really full stack mindset. And like at my current job, we operate at a much higher level, and we are much more commercially successful. So, and I see the majority of the companies making kind of more choices to stay more shallow on the stack and just like keep the experience like higher level, but the operations kind of pan out, and it works because you usually don't have to debug the JVM. It works because you usually don't have to debug the Linux kernel. The question is, if you build its LLM apps, do you usually have to go to the source or to the bytecode or to do the assembly? So how deep have to go? Yeah.
As I said, in my point of view, it's going to be very interesting because I don't know how many people you know that know about lithography and type and offset print, but I don't know too many.
Is that typography where you are putting stuff on in the books, or is it?
Exactly.
Exactly.
And what type of serifs to use for what sentiment and things like that. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Shall we wrap it up?
Yeah, I think so. All right. Thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed it, the whole conversation. And yeah, I hope... thank you also to all the listeners who made it so far. No.
that's brave. Congratulations.
Yeah. I think we made a few very interesting points
we will let the listener be the judge of that, Sven.
Yeah, but you know, my goal is always the first goal is guaranteed audience of one, you know. If we learn something, it's great. Somebody else learns something, that's
greater,
exactly. But I'm sure if you know, if we have some aha moments, and I had a few, other people will have aha moments too.
Exactly. I mean, that was how this conversation came to be, right? That we said, exactly. Well, people asked us about the conversations that we had and said, we would like to listen to that. And we said, well, we anyway talk to each other, so we can as well record it.
Exactly. I really see a session that we record where we are having physical beers in our hand and standing around a fireplace.
It will happen.
It will.
I see myself with one of Sven's cats.
Yeah. I don't know if you recognize it, but I had one of the cats on my...
We recognized it because of this.
Ah, okay. Yeah, exactly. The tail was floating. Exactly. Yeah, all right. Not going into details what can happen with a cat on you during a call.
Thank you very much. And have a good evening.
Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye, guys.